When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Louisa Han, and I'm really pleased to be joined today by Karis Enns to discuss her new book, Settler Ecologies, The Enduring Nature of Settler Colonialism in Kenya, written with Brock Bozzaglio and recently released by University of Toronto Press. Karis, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about the book.
Great. So just to give the audience some context about the conversation we're about to have, I'm taking a slight detour from my usual spot, hosting the Critical Theory Channel to interview Karis, who is a colleague at the University of Manchester's Global Development Institute, where she's currently Presidential Fellow in Socio-Environmental Systems. So Karis, I wonder if you just mind just introducing the audience to your research interests and background briefly.
Sure. Yes, so as you said, I'm a Presidential Fellow at the Global Development Institute. My research sits in between critical development studies, geography, and political ecology, but with a focus on human-animal interactions and relations. I tend to approach my research in quite a politically engaged way, influenced by the scholar activism tradition, placing emphasis on theory and learning and reflection, but also action and social transformation to create a better world for both humans and non-humans.
Great, thanks. So I guess before we dive into questions, I'll just say that I found the book quite accessible and engaging. When kind of prepping this interview, I came into it with pretty fresh eyes, I suppose, given that I'm not necessarily an expert in the field of political ecology. But I found kind of the analysis of how settler colonial structures have been kind of intimately entwined with ecological transformations in Kenya really interesting. And for me, they threw kind of a new light on some of the debates surrounding how we address like mounting biodiversity crises, really. So in that sense, I think it could be of interest to quite a broad audience, in both the sense of like anti-colonial critique and ecological politics, although there are probably some more specific kind of scholarly debates we can discuss about where the book really makes its mark. So with that in mind, could you just introduce us to the overall kind of purpose of the book and how you came to write it? Where does it make its intervention?
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, the book really is a personal project, or it started as a personal project, I guess. I should say that both me, myself, and the co-author, Brock Bozzaglio, who's at the University of Birmingham, were both white settlers twice over, roots in North America, and then grew up or spent a lot of time growing up in East and Southern Africa. Both of us were very drawn to the conservation sector growing up, as a lot of white settlers in these regions are, and wanted to work in the conservation sector. And as we went through our academic careers, became more critical of the sector and its role in sustaining settler colonial power. So the book grew out of this kind of desire or longing to be part of this sector, the wildlife, the wilderness that so many white settlers are drawn to, but also feeling a real responsibility to critique it. In terms of its aims and what it aspires to do, it intends to show that ecological relations are just as much a part of settler colonial structures as other things we think about more often are, like political institutions and labor and property regimes. With these processes, we know that they pull the past, the settler colonial past, into the present, but often we forget that animals and plants can do the same. And so the book tries to shine light on this.
Great. And kind of on the point of settler colonialism, before we dive into the book's chapters, it might be helpful just to clarify the terms of debate here. But, you know, could you briefly explain how you distinguish settler colonialism from classical colonialism in terms of its kind of oppressive imperatives, forms of dispossession, and kind of relation to the land?
Yeah, so we go into this in a little bit in the opening of the book. For us, this is an interesting question and topic because Kenya isn't normally thrown into the category group of a settler colony. When we think about contemporary settler colonies, we tend to think about North America, Australia, maybe Israel, Palestine. We don't often think about East and Southern Africa as contemporary settler colonies, but for us, especially where the research we do in central Kenya, where we're based, it remains a real stronghold of settler colonial power. And we think there's a lot of importance to interrogate these little pockets of settler colonial power that exist all around the world. So in defining settler colonialism and differentiating it from colonialism, we obviously draw on a really long history of this work to say that whereas colonialism was about extracting materials and indentured labor for the purpose of the metropole, settler colonialism was about this plus coming to stay with the intention of remaining permanently, as I think Hughes and Wolfe use that phrase first. So in Kenya, you had this extraction of wealth. So you had this kind of classical colonialism, but you also had large populations of British, primarily at first, coming to stay as they extracted, coming to change institutions and political relations and economic relations. And many of these families remain really prominent in central Kenya today, which makes this pocket of Kenya a settler colony, not just a post colony.
As you kind of note in the book, settler colonialism, it's kind of had a kind of certain porosity to it. It takes on different forms and imperatives like over time. And your book kind of tracks the ecological impacts of this from, you know, the earlier days of colonialism in Kenya to today. So I guess let's start from the beginning with the establishment of settler colonies. What did the land and the wildlife kind of look like? And how did settlers go about changing things?
Yeah, so that's such an interesting debate, and it's one that we've kind of followed. We don't go into too much detail because there's so much discussion about what the landscape looked like when colonizers arrived. And I think the history is really murky because the written history, the colonial history, tells us that the landscape wasn't healthy, people weren't healthy, animals weren't healthy, as part of a way to justify the intervention that happened. And because there isn't a lot of written history that's not from the colonizer's point of view, it's been hard to, I think, unmake that narrative that the land wasn't healthy when colonizers arrived. So I would go on to say that the oral history is really clear that when colonizers arrived, there were thriving pastoral and agropastoral communities. There were abundant populations of wildlife and livestock, likely not to the abundance we see today, but abundance and maybe balance. But I think where you land in that debate probably partly depends on, yeah, whose history you read into. When colonizers arrived, they needed to make the land appear as though it was empty, unhealthy, awaiting transformation so that they could set up their own settler colony and extract resources in the service of empire. So they quickly set about clearing land of plants, of animals, importing and bringing in new plants and animals, ones they thought had more economic potential, in order to really recreate their homeland in Kenya. And there's a lot of quotes in the book where you can just see this kind of longing to recreate trout fisheries, and certain like plants and garden styles in England were brought to Kenya during this time.
Yeah, I really got the sense of reading the book, there were kind of these imaginaries of England that weren't necessarily, you know, realistic, but, you know, English pasture, etc. Yeah, interesting. So let's kind of fast forward a bit to Kenyan independence in the 60s. So by this point, you kind of write about how species and biodiversity loss were highly apparent following the decades of land clearing that you mentioned, hunting and plant and animal importation, etc. So how did the kind of the next generation of settlers, or at least, you know, those who remained, reckon with this past and start to address ecological issues in this post-independence era?
Yeah, so this post-independence era is really interesting because settlers were facing multiple types of crises, which we talk about in the book. They're facing the crisis that every white settler faced in colonies at this point, which was what happens to them at the time of independence. Do they stay or do they go? At the same time, they're facing economic crises because their beef markets aren't as secure anymore, and their agricultural markets, they're not as favored. They don't have kind of a right to do better than Indigenous populations anymore written in law. So there's this economic crisis. And also they're noticing that their land is not sustaining them the way it did in the past. A lot of the kind of agro industries they tried to set up weren't working, not just because of economic policies or legal change, but just because of the environment wasn't sustainable. There was soil problems and pests. Problems. And so they start thinking about how they can fix or solve all these economic crises at once. And at this time, they turn to wildlife. So the wildlife they had worked to clear off their land just a few decades before also becomes a solution to multiple crises they face. And quickly, some of the most successful private conservancies we see today, they're owned by settlers. At that time, quickly they realized, actually, if we're able to rewild our landscapes, repopulate them with wildlife, we might be able to resolve some of these interlinked crises we face that risk us are losing our land. And so at this point, we see real efforts to rewild, to bring populations back, to create ranches that are now wildlife friendly. And the efforts were successful pretty quickly. It only took a couple decades to start seeing this like revitalization of wildlife on their land.
Yeah. And in terms of like the kind of attitudes towards the destructive histories, was there a kind of sense that they needed to kind of sanitize it a bit? Like, because you mentioned in the book a kind of like sentimentalism surrounding nature, maybe during this kind of era, more shift towards that rather than, you know, the era when there's a bit in the book where you talk about like lions, for example, are sort of thought of as kind of vermin in a way that just the total change in like attitude there. So was this a kind of another kind of wider like hegemonic change in terms of how people viewed nature and their place in it, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such an interesting time period. There's actually a really nice book by someone called Janet McIntosh who talks about, I forget the atonement. She talks about atonement during this period among white settler communities and how they often were atoning for previous generations' actions by trying to be better to their staff, their labor, and often doing this by learning language, local language, to kind of try to show that they were different than past generations. And in our book, we talk about how we see the exact same thing happening with wildlife. There's this real effort to kind of detach themselves from what past generations had done to wildlife, to acknowledge and try to atone for that past wrongdoing and make right what the previous generations had done. It's so interesting to me that you see this in many parts of settler life during this period, this atonement across environmental factors, features, across how they interact with labor, how they fit into politics, but you don't see it with land. There's no atonement or reckoning with the taking and exploitation of land. And even up into this day, you don't see that. So it's interesting, like how far that kind of reckoning extends into settler life and then where it ends. And that's because land and the taking of land is this defining feature of settler colonialism. And if you atone for taking land, then settler colonialism really does lose its power.
So I suppose the role of wildlife conservancies in kind of these settler ecologies is examined in depth throughout the book. And I mean, superficially, at least to someone like me, who is relatively unfamiliar with this kind of area, the term sounds like an unequivocal good and its aims to preserve and protect. As your book kind of makes clear, the establishment of conservancies has been fraught with kind of conflict and hostilities. So can you just kind of go into some of the reasons behind kind of these conflicts a little bit deeper, as well as the wider political dynamics in places like Apia, which is where you're kind of focusing on?
Yeah, so I do think there is this idea in kind of popular discourse that conservancies have to be good. That's been heavily challenged in kind of political ecology, environmental politics literature, by showing that conservancies are always contested and fraught. And the existing literature shows us really clearly that if you look at land politics, institutions of governance, laws and policies in conservancies, there's just this long history of people losing their ability to use and access lands in ways that they need to survive, in ways that are embedded in national and human rights law. A lot of this is lost when conservancies are put in place. So that's that critique that we see already well established in the literature. The critique we make in our book tries to kind of add or build on this by looking at the animals and plant life that end up present in conservancies. I think also in popular discourse, there's this idea that conserving is always good, regardless of what one is conserving. And something we want to bring attention to is that what is conserved in a wildlife conservancy is always a reflection of who has power. There's always choices made in what plants or animals are being conserved. And in settler colonial contexts, those choices often serve to reproduce settler colonial power, settler colonial interests. And so in the case of Laikipia, what you see being conserved are charismatic species, species that align with people's ideas of wilderness, species that are easy to commodify, species that fit into kind of documentaries and wilderness photography, exactly what you imagine. And because settlers have dominance in the safari industry, they make their money through the wildlife sector, reproducing these species within conservancies serves to benefit some at the expense of others. And there are other types of species that you could conserve in conservancies that would serve an entirely different purpose. And so that's the kind of contested story we draw out in the book.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Yeah, I was also really interested in terms of like who's enlisted to kind of labor on these conservancies, essentially. So I remember there's one point in the book where you mentioned meeting a member of the staff at a conservancy who's told to speak Swahili rather than English in front of American tourists, just to kind of generate what I suppose is this kind of performance of otherness to align with racialized fictions, basically. Can you just kind of go into this a little bit more in terms of how Indigenous or kind of otherwise racialized people are absorbed into and participate in conservancy projects?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, again, it just follows perfectly from the previous question, because alongside this narrative that everything that's conserved in a conservancy is good because it's doing the work of biodiversity conservation, there's often the idea that every time a job is created through a conservancy, that's good because it contributes to livelihoods and local economic development. And again, what we try to problematize through the book is that sometimes those economic opportunities, those livelihood opportunities, often or can be used to reproduce certain structures of power, in this case, settler colonial power. So you can imagine a world where jobs that are created within conservancies really do give people more sovereignty, more self-determination over themselves and their livelihoods and their land. But what often happens in conservancies is that people are enrolled in very instrumental ways to help reinforce stories about what wild Africa and wilderness, these colonial imaginaries of Africa, look like. So in the book, we talk about, as you said, this case of someone who speaks perfect English being told he needs to speak Swahili instead in front of guests to kind of reproduce this idea of the uninformed native who plays the labor role. He serves a purpose as labor to the white guide, which is so not a reflection of reality in the context. It's a reproduction of the colonial past. And although there's an income and a job that comes out of filling that role, there's something that also needs to be critiqued, which is that someone has to play or perform the role of a person in the colonial past in order to get access to that livelihood opportunity. And that's really problematic.
Yeah, so let's kind of go into the politics of rescuing as well, because this is you dedicate a chapter to this as well, which is again something which might sound very noble to an outsider, but actually comes with lots of consequences for the region's indigenous communities and its ecological integrity. So can you just kind of explain some of the ways that species protections can impact the environment, as well as how kind of protection projects create these justifications for using military technologies, is one thing you talk about, that these things that affect the lives of local people.
Yeah, so that's one of our favorite chapters to write. We write about animal sanctuaries and orphanages, which are often placed with, or increasingly placed within, conservancies as a way to rescue or protect endangered species, but also a really good income generating fundraising tool. Within these sanctuaries or animal orphanages, tourists can pay an additional fee to come hold a baby animal or feed a baby animal a bottle. So it's quite amazing. It is a remarkable experience for tourists to have. And one of the things we raise in the book is that although we have a need, we all recognize the global biodiversity crisis is real and there's a need to protect endangered species. Certain models are being used to protect endangered species that create risks for both people that live in the area, but also for the animal itself. So we write about the creation of quasi-wild animal populations. These elephants, in this case, that grow up neither wild nor domestic and then are re-released. They're so accustomed to being around humans, and humans in the area aren't accustomed to being around them. So you see these kind of growing populations of, say, elephant or whatever the sanctuary or orphanage is, that don't really know how to exist in the world without human support, and that often end up in really dangerous situations, too close to humans, taking food from humans in human habitats, with humans that aren't used to them, and it can end up with human wildlife conflict. And to avoid that, then there has to be this growing emphasis on keeping these endangered populations that are only quasi-wild secure as they grow up. And this means having to rely on more fences and technologies and military forces or military-like forces to keep these quasi-wild animals safe, who don't really know how to exist in the wild, but also can't grow up completely domestic. So it's this model of conservation that all over the world we see people, organizations turning to animal sanctuaries and orphanages to protect highly endangered species. And it's rarely problematized or critiqued. But when you look at what it actually achieves and at the risk it can place animals in long term, also just when they're little, there's a lot of stress for wild animals having to have a lot of really constant interaction with humans. We say there's maybe something to question here. Maybe this model of conservation is actually more about its ability to fundraise, its ability to give people experiences with animals that are very effective and emotive, than it is actually about being the most effective way to save highly endangered species.
Yeah, and another thing I found really interesting about this chapter was kind of you talk about shift from rescuing as something that's quite gendered and kind of ad hoc, and then it becomes something more systematized and actually like enlists animals as laborers because they become research fodder, right?
Yeah, I think that was an interesting piece that came out of writing that we hadn't really expected. There's this really impressive history of settler women, again, all over the world. We read about Kenya specifically, but you see it all over the world, of settler women being in colonies and being responsible for their family or their home, but then also playing this kind of side role of caring for young injured animals. And things like bottled formula for orphaned elephants are inventions of women, are inventions of women's labor. And I think it's really important to recognize that women, often without like training, without scientific support, without fundraising, have done these really impressive things to advance biodiversity conservation. So that's one side of the story. But as you said, over time, it has become increasingly not just a hobby of women or settler women, but something that has systematically been taken into the conservation sector to fundraise, has become, part of biodiversity conservation science. And again, this is important. We need to advance biodiversity conservation science and technologies. That's an important piece of addressing the biodiversity conservation crisis. But who has the ability to advance science? Who has the land and access to technology, access to labs to do research on endangered species? Who has access to medicines and wildlife veterinary care to rescue endangered species? Often falls to certain people that already have a lot of power and wealth, thereby reproducing existing forms of power within lands.
Yeah, so let's on that point of kind of addressing the ecological crises, move on to kind of the final chapter of the book, where you explore kind of some of the latest developments in ecological conservation. As you note, some of the negative ecological consequences of kind of cutting off areas for conservation are becoming clearer, especially as biodiversity continues to decline. So can you just kind of explain some of the primary challenges and political and ecological implications of kind of scaling up these conservancy efforts?
Yeah. So I think it's fairly undisputed that we need to set aside more land where people and animals can live in harmony, where there can be biodiverse landscapes, truly biodiverse landscapes, if we're going to ward off the biodiversity crisis. That's just true. That's just what needs to be done if we're going to resolve the problems we're facing. However, the way that more land is being secured for conservation in many parts of the world raises several problems. And one of the problems we talk about in the book is reliance on basically single species conservation. So setting aside large amounts of land to preserve a certain species or to really prioritize a certain species at the expense of truly biodiverse landscapes. And along with this goes a fear that if you have humans in the landscape at all, you risk your conservation efforts being unsuccessful. And so in parts of Laikipia, what's happening is that large areas of land are being secured and changed in ownership or tenure style in order to protect certain really charismatic species, in order to meet certain goals that the country and the world has for increasing the amount of land set aside for conservation, but in ways that risk creating landscapes that really only serve a few species. And this means that any species that doesn't fit within that landscape story, that doesn't fit within the model that's being set up, is disadvantaged. And the key example, or the prime example, is rhino. So in many parts of eastern southern Africa, in order to conserve rhino populations well, you need to have really secure landscapes. They are at risk of poaching. They also can contract disease if they're mixed too much with other types of animals. There's lots of reasons why you do need to have secure landscapes to keep rhino populations healthy and growing as they are right now in Laikipia. But the overwhelming focus on rhino in certain parts of the county risks creating really, really large tracts of land, growing tracts of land that basically only serve rhino and a few other populations, and risk leaving out species that don't fit within rhino's landscapes, according to conservationists, which is pastoralists, their livestock, and all the plant species that serve pastoralists well.
Great. And I mean, this opens up obviously so many questions about what the solutions are to all of this. But I suppose a good question then is, like, what's next for kind of critical scholarship surrounding ecology and conservancy in Kenya? Like, what do you think your book has left unaddressed, or kind of what kind of research has it laid the foundations for, really?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the kind of what's next is already being done, and probably was, it already was, not probably, it very much was already being done before we wrote our book. So we end the book by talking about the need for continued support for ecologies otherwise, which are diverse, both in terms of culturally diverse and biodiverse landscapes that sustain indigenous populations of humans, but also indigenous populations of animals in multiple ways. And I think there are a lot of people all around the world and settler colonies all around the world doing work on how we create these ecologies otherwise, these non-settler ecologies. And that work needs to continue to happen. The practicalities of how you create these ecologies otherwise, I think, is very much important work to continue seeing unfold and being supported. At the same time, I think that our book, one of the things we really hope it does is opens a debate for questioning what species are in a landscape and why. In conservation conversations and discussions, especially at the global level, there continues to just be this idea or assumption that all we need to do is save animals and plants, with no underlying conversation about which animals and plants do we prioritize. The reality is, we, in every landscape, there's a need to make decisions about what plants and animals are going to be prioritized with the limited amount of financing we have. And so in some ways, the book is asking us to take a step back and, instead of focusing on conservation at large, opening the discussion about who makes decisions about what's conserved in different landscapes.
Great. And I suppose my final question, leading on from that, is what are you working on at the moment? What's next? What's going on?
Yes. So we're just, me and my co-author Brock, have just started working on a project related to zoonotic disease and insects. And the main question that this, we're going to do another book project, the book will ask, is how do we coexist? How do we live in worlds with insects that bring disease? How do we create worlds where we can coexist with ticks and mosquitoes and all of these insects that are risky to our health, to animals' health, and are increasing in a world undergoing climate change? But we need to figure out how to live with them in ways that don't just involve killing them and don't just involve spraying, but actually truly coexist. If we're going to increase biodiversity in the world, obviously we're still thinking through exactly how we do this project in the book, but that's the next big project, truly multi-species coexistence, including with insects that we as humans tend to want to avoid.
Right. That sounds fascinating. Okay. Right. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much again for taking the time to do this. It was really fun.
Great.